grand juries found no case to be made against police officers in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island, New York, who killed unarmed black men. And if that doesn't mean the system is broken, it's certainly bent. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We're continuing a statewide discussion we kicked off last week, and our phone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK toll-free. A local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. The question, what are the implications for this, for where we live today on Talk of Alaska statewide?
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Yeah, everybody's got an opinion on this one. 1-800-478-8255. I want to congratulate the callers last week for some of the most thoughtful participation we've ever had on this show, and our guest Charles D. Hayes, and we could get even deeper this time around. We've got two great guests. First, I would like to introduce Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve, for having me on today.
And you were just telling me before we began that we had a march over the Ferguson, Staten Island issues in Anchorage yesterday, and the police were there, and there were no issues.
Well, we worked hard to keep it that way. We have great support from the community. We helped work things out in advance with the organizers, which was the local chapter of the NAACP. We've got some good friends over there, and I think it worked out well for everybody.
Now, I don't want to be tossing softballs, but I'll toss one more at you. and that is the profiling. You know, you're watching the Attorney General of the United States releasing profiling guidelines for the for federal officers. They don't apply to local police departments, but I understand APD has its own profiling guideline, which is essentially no profiling.
That's correct. The APD has never had a policy that approved a profiling, and you know, back in the, I want to say it was probably the early 90s, we became aware of the term profiling. It was never something that was an authorized program at the APD, and when we saw what was happening nationwide, we made sure that our policies did not permit anything like that. And so our policies are online, by the way. You can look them up, and our policy entitled Unbiased Policing is the one that forbids racial profiling, and it's there online.
And what would this, I mean, there's certain things that, would constitute probable cause. I mean, an erratic driving thing would be one, right?
Well, yeah, there's two thresholds that the officers are going to use that pertain to this particular discussion. One would be reasonable suspicion. The other would be probable cause. And that tells you, the first, reasonable suspicion, tells you when you've got enough information to stop somebody briefly, detain them for further questioning, maybe pat them down if make sure they haven't got a knife or a gun. It's not like a full-blown look, take off your shoes, look between your toes type of thing, but, you know, just a frisk. And there's legal standards for what constitutes reasonable suspicion. And that's not based on the race of somebody. It's based on other factors, and we can go into some of those. The next one would be probable cause. That's a higher burden of proof. That's where we decide that an arrest is appropriate, that the crime has most likely been committed. This is the person who most likely committed it. It's a little higher bar. It's still much lower than what's needed as a conviction. But the officers are trained, and the system is comfortable with these terms, and we all have a fairly good idea of where these two bars are. And that's what drives our decisions.
Where we went with the discussion last week went a lot to the area of, I guess you would call it, scared police or culturally alienated police, or something like that. It was the idea that if the officer is not acquainted with the cultural characteristics of the neighborhood that they're in, they're more likely to be on their guard, which would only be natural. But also, things can get out of control more quickly because each side maybe is not really interpreting the signals from the other side. Now, I know any officers going to want to try and give clear signals, but that might not be so clear on the other side of the transaction.
I'm sure that can occur.
And apparently,
and I'm not going to say it's never occurred in Anchorage, don't get me wrong, but we have so many different cultures here anymore. What do we talk about? 90-some of them, different languages and so forth. So you're always running into somebody from a different culture with a different set of language skills or lack of language skills. So communication is always the key. When things go bad, it's oftentimes a lack of communication that contributes to it.
Yeah.
We keep that in mind, and we try to over-communicate if the circumstances will allow us to.
So is there a formal type of training program for sensitivity or cross-cultural communication or anything of that nature?
Well, we do discuss these things in the academy. There is a course in the academy that the recruits go to that prepares them for this. Some of this you can't just teach, though. I mean, it's hard to teach somebody who's not sensitive to be sensitive. I mean, we talk about the importance of doing it, but they're going to develop those skills as they start working on the street, or they're not going to make it through their training. So most of it is, I mean, some of it is classroom, certainly. Some of it is learning to apply what you've learned in classroom during your field training, where you actually start figuring out what works for you and what's getting you in trouble.
1-800-478-8255 is the telephone number. Police profiling and deadly force among the issues being discussed today. Your participation is welcome. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and the email can be handy at talk@alaskapublic.org. Also with us by telephone in Washington, D.C. is Elizabeth Beavers. She is Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Elizabeth, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Wow. Busy day in Washington, huh?
Very busy day. A lot of things happening. Congress likes to wait until the very last second to get things done. But like I said, I am just glad that they're doing something.
Yeah, doing something. One thing they seem to be doing is going into the torture issue in the CIA. And boy, that's got to have everybody buzzing there right now.
Oh, yeah. That's the big news item today. I do work for a Quaker organization, and we're very engaged on issues of war and peace and national security and civil liberties. And the release of this torture report is sort of the culmination of everything. And it's kept us very busy today, but mostly we're just sort of in a state of real grief going through it and reading some of these disclosures.
As I guess just about anybody would be. Elizabeth, I think we're going to try and reestablish our connection with you because we seem to be losing signal. So I'll bid you goodbye, and we'll try and redial and see if we can't get a better connection and go back to Chief Mew. If you're ready for some phone calls.
Sure.
Okay. We'll go for it then. Tim joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tim.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. How about you?
Good, I'm good. I'm kind of opinionating on this subject. I'm the son of a 23-year police officer, but I have my own experiences with, you know, the police at home and out in the public. And so I just feel that, you know, we're focusing way too much on this being a color or a social issue as far as, you know, an ethnic issue. I think it's more of, I think we're gearing our police up to be more militarized. I heard somebody say it the other day that, you know, we're arming them with all this tactical weaponry, dressing them up in camouflage, and asking them to act like a human being when actually we're preparing them for war. And so how can we not expect them to react the way that they're reacting? And one of my own experiences in my own life as a young man is the police asked me to stop, and then they pulled a gun out on me because I wasn't stopping. I was on foot, and I didn't have any weapons in my hand, but for some reason they felt it necessary to pull a gun on me. And I kind of wonder, why is that the first reaction of the police is to pull out a gun? I mean, it seems to be the reaction of all these unarmed people that have been shot, is the gun comes out. Why the gun? Why are we training our police officers to pull out their gun?
Okay, well, I do know
that appalls me.
Okay, well, I will just say this a little bit and then turn it over to Chief Mew. I believe that a lot of the holsters have a kind of a flap on it, and there's actually things you have to do before you would be able to even use that firearm. But Chief Mew, I'm assuming there must be some guidelines on that sort of encounter.
Oh, certainly there are. The caller has had questions about militarization and also on use of force. So let me take the use of force one first. That was the second notion. Officers are required to use the least amount of force necessary to accomplish the task. So sometimes you can get things done with no force at all. Sometimes it's just your command presence. Sometimes it's a sleeve guide, just kind of directing somebody. Sometimes, you know, it escalates and we go through a variety of defensive tactics or hands-on things and eventually into the use of certain tools. The firearm is one of those, and it's at the extreme end of things. The officer has to be able to articulate why that level of force was necessary. The courts have ruled that, there's a reasonable man, third-party approach. It has to be what would be a reasonable person would, in similar circumstances, would construe to be necessary to use that level of force. Now, the officers are allowed by state law to threaten use of force, threaten deadly force, even when deadly force is not yet justifiable. In other words, take a defensive position with a handgun because you think something could happen that it hasn't happened yet. An easy example would be clearing a warehouse in the dark when there's a burglar alarm going off. You're sneaking around in there. Officers may have their weapons out while they clear that, even though we haven't seen a suspect yet and haven't confronted anybody yet. So there are some times when a weapon can be out before, the decision to use the weapon is imminent. And this is all established in case law, and the officers are trained on when to do it. So in the hypothetical, hypothetical, because to him it wasn't hypothetical, but the situation the gentleman in, the caller was in, I don't know enough information to know what the officer suspected him of, maybe he was mistaken for a bank robber that had a similar appearance to him that was in the same area.
That would definitely change the threshold.
That would change the threshold. So yeah. I can't answer that question without knowing all the ins and outs of that specific encounter. But certainly if the officer wanted to chat him up about the possibilities in possession of an overdue library book, I don't believe that it would have been appropriate to produce a weapon to do that. And the officer would be disciplined for that. If, however, we suspected the gentleman of robbing a bank, or he had the same description of a bank robber in the area from 10 minutes ago, that might have been appropriate. So it just depends on what the circumstances were, and I don't know what those are right now.
Tim, did you feel there was something about you that might have triggered this?
Oh, well, I don't want to get into the detail on that. It just bothers me why that's the first course of action. Stop. That's fine. Give me the stop. You don't have to pull out a gun to give me the stop.
If he asks you to stop...
But a reasonable person doesn't pull out a gun to get somebody to stop. I'm allowed to open carry here in Alaska, so if I pull out my gun and tell somebody to stop just because I want them to stop, I'm allowed to do that? But the way the police get away with this is they get laws that allow them to use deadly force, like the chief said. There's a law here in PIS that allows the police to do what they do. And that's part of the problem what's happened in New York with the killing and the grand jury not indicting him. In that situation, is the law allows them to do whatever the hell they want to do.
Well, I don't think it allows us to do whatever we want to do. And I'm not saying that the that the officer's actions in your story were correct or incorrect. I don't have enough information to make that determination.
Yeah, we kind of lost the signal there anyway, Tim. I may be running out of battery power or something, not sure. So before we go to the militarization issue that he also raised, Chief Mew, I believe we have Elizabeth Beavers back at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Elizabeth?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. That's much better. Yeah, and you work this issue quite a bit. The one question I wanted to ask you, and that someone told me, I don't even know if it's true or not. Maybe you don't. Maybe Chief Mew doesn't, but he should know. If a police department gets military gear, there's some kind of requirement for actually having to deploy it, or they have to give it back.
Well, so the current regulations of the department, specifically to the Department of Defense 1033 program, which allows the weapons and gear to be transferred for free, there is a current regulation as part of the Memorandum of Understanding that does require that the item be used or be put to use within a year, or else it is supposed to be returned. Now, interpretation of what put to use means is certainly debatable, and I think different localities interpret that in a different way, but there are quite a few that interpret that to mean actual deploying of the weapon or you know, utilization of the weapon or whatever. So although, you know, then we see some that use like a mine resistant ambush protected vehicle in a parade or something and say they use it for the year. So I think there are different interpretations of that, but that's correct. It is a current regulation.
And so you see a problem with that, I would think.
Well, you know, we just think that that is a local decision. That's not something that should be in any way required by federal law or if something is to be utilized by local law enforcement.
So
we think it kind of provides a dangerous incentivization.
If you had your choice, would you get rid of or drastically modify the 1033 program?
Right. So what we've been supporting is called the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act, and it would not get rid of the entire program because the truth is that the vast majority of what's transferred through the program is helpful and benign, and from what we've heard, the feedback we've understood is that it's really helpful for law enforcement. We are supporters of law enforcement. We don't want to work against them. We want them to be able to do their jobs. And a lot of what goes through is like furniture and office equipment and things that we certainly don't have a problem with. What we do have an issue with is an over-availability of high-level, really complex, military-grade items that officers may or may not be trained to use, may not use appropriately, or in some cases maybe shouldn't be used in law enforcement at all. And we think we're totally missing out on the debate of that when we make it so overly accessible. So the bill that we're supporting would rein in the program by stopping the free transfer of some of these more egregious items and putting some more restrictions in place in terms of eligibility.
Oh, fascinating. And who's put this forth? And where do you think it might go in the next session?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. This is something that a few congressmen have been working on for about a year now, but then after Ferguson happened, it put the issue in the national spotlight in the way it hadn't been previously. So now what we have is in the House of Representatives, Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia, a Democrat, and Congressman Raul Labrador of Idaho, a Republican, they co-introduced the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act, and it's picked up about 50 co-sponsors in the House so far, both Democrats and Republicans. On the Senate side, right now, it's Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma introduced it, and he was joined by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. And that's
so those are not exactly liberals.
Right, exactly. That's what's really fascinating. It's fun for me working on this issue is working with so many different types of people and hearing a lot of common interests from radically different perspectives. It's not so often we get to do that around here.
Yeah, I think we have even done shows on the subject of green is the new red, which probably you're familiar with. Maybe Chief Mew is too. I'm not really sure, but it's the idea that the what were once called environmental terrorists, that the definition has been expanded to the point where it's considered to be terrorism when somebody is environmental, and that obviously, you know, surveillance tactics and so forth could be onerous in a situation like that. We have dealt with that in the past, but I want to bring Chief Mew back in this. You've been very, very silent. You've been you've been holding back, so I want to let you at this at this one, Chief Mew, because I know when this started to become an issue, APD tried to get out in front of it by actually saying, well, here's the stuff we got, have a look at it.
Sure, and we we show our equipment off quite a bit. Almost none of it is gotten through the program that we're discussing here.
1033.
Yes, we used to have a different name for it, and it was an old acronym, I'm not up with the new version of it. But we have gotten hand-me-down military equipment in the past. Most of it's been things like blankets and first aid stuff, some snowshoes once. We might have gotten some second-generation night vision goggles for the SWAT team back in the early 90s, or maybe those were just ones we borrowed for training from the Guard. I can't really recall now. But we haven't got the big-ticket items that you guys are talking about, the MRAPs and things like that. We were on the verge of an MRAP for a while and decided for reasons unrelated to this program and this discussion that we wanted to, we turned them down on it and didn't complete the transaction.
So what kind of gear, when there was that incident like a couple of weekends ago downtown, where it was just a big old party of some sort going on, it was a lot of people and it used all units, including airport and campus police. And they came in full gear, it was said. What did that consist of then?
Well, I don't know who said we came in full gear.
Okay.
And I don't know what that, I'll tell you right now that, and we've made no secret about this, we had a class for this for the media on our policies and our response tactics and so forth for both protests and riots some months ago. If we're going to a demonstration of some kind, we go in Class A uniforms. That means long sleeve shirts, and we essentially dress up to come to the rally. Now, if it happens on a summer night, and the on duties arrive, they happen to be in their short sleeve uniform shirts. But I mean, if we call in reinforcements, they're going to come dressed like I am right now, and. We said we want to look like municipal policemen. We do not come looking like the military. Now, if things get out of hand, we may start layering on other equipment. It may be necessary for us to put on a helmet, and all the officers have a helmet in their car. I don't know whether the helmets came out or not on this thing that happened the other night. But, if anybody's telling you that the SWAT team came or that we're in some kind of wearing some sort of exoskeleton or something like that with shin guards and shoulder guards and face shields and stuff like that. I don't know. Maybe I can't say that there isn't a face shield on some helmets, but a lot of the helmets I see, most of them don't have face shields. So I think that would have been an overstatement for what would have occurred or what did occur here in Anchorage with that party that got out of hand a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, so it's how about an armored? There's the bomb squad that is basically military, right?
Oh, I'm not telling you we don't have some pretty neat, depending on your point of view, equipment. But it's not. We didn't acquire it from military sources. Everybody's seen the Len Colbert. You can go online and Google that. You can see it. We paid money for that. It's assigned to the SWAT team. We bring it out for SWAT operations sometimes if the operation looks like it's going to require something like that. We bring it out for all the youth activities and let the kids crawl around on it and in it. It's armored. One of its best abilities is it's large and can hold a lot of people and protect them from bullets. So if we have to back it up against an apartment complex and load up the residents and get them out of the line of fire, we can do that safely. Can we do?
Chief Mew, you're talking about this thing as if it were a friend of the family.
Well, it can do forceful things too. I'm not saying that it can't, but we're cognizant of how often we bring it out, and we want to bring it out for the right things, and not, gratuitously display this stuff as some sort of threat or something. There are times and places for these tools. There are also times and places where, you don't bring this stuff out.
Let's, Elizabeth Beavers, we'll get back to you in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, but I want to turn to Bob in Soldotna now and see what he has to say. Bob, welcome to Talk of Alaska, and thanks for waiting.
Yes, greetings, Steve. Listening to this makes me glad I live in a little cabin down here in the Kenai. I wouldn't want to live in a big city. We've trained more security and military police since the beginning of the first Gulf War Desert Storm than that have ever been trained in this country since we have had police and military. And I have a friend who was an Anchorage police officer for 22 years. We got the P-Willing beat out of him by a guy. I don't remember all the details. He was an Anchorage cop. Well, the guy grabbed a 2x4, and you know, I learned this when he gave me. He's now an institution at the State Crime Lab in Anchorage. He gave me a tour of that. He had this picture by his desk. He showed me how brutally he'd been beaten by this individual. Anyway, I have the utmost respect for my friend, and he's been a family friend since before I was born. But I lived in Boise when my folks retired. I went to high school down there, and kids used to always go over to Boise and cruise Idaho and Main Street. It was a big circle, you know. They've done that since my parents were in high school in the 30s down there. I mean, it was just a thing to do. And then somebody in the Boise City Council decided they didn't want kids cruising Idaho and Main Street anymore. So they put an ordinance to stop that. Well, I guess the Boise police are a training ground for Los Angeles police officers. And anyway, this was back, I guess, in the late 80s, early 90s when I was living down there. But these two brothers got pulled over. I guess one of the brothers initiated fire on the police officers, but soon several units showed up and a firefight began, and one of the brothers was hit. And you can clearly hear in the video the guy screaming at the police, "My brother's been hit, stop, you know, I give up." And they riddled both of them with 14 bullets each. Another incident was a kid, an 18-year-old kid, parked with his engine idling on Idaho or Main Street, one of the two there in downtown Boise. And a Boise police officer came up to him and reached into the car and tried to grab the keys out of the ignition. While the engine was running, I'm familiar with that type of car because I was an automotive technician for many years. The police officer claimed that the kid put it in gear, started to drive away, and was dragging him. I think because it was an automatic transmission car, in the struggle, the police officer hit the drive the shifter and put it in gear himself accidentally. He pulled out his sidearm and shot this 18-year-old kid in the head, point-blank range. And the police officer won the civil suit in the court battle. But, you know, that was a big issue down there for a long time. But, you know, also I heard the Broward County Police Sheriff's Department ordered 5 Apache helicopters. I mean, you know, what is becoming in this country? I mean, you know, we have these riots going down here. You know, what was it, Charlie Manson was released from prison this year, and he warned us of the pending race war in this country. I bet he's been watching the news quite closely here and probably laughing at us. But, you know, we all grew up here in Alaska, at least back in the day that I grew up here, and probably Steve did. But we all shared together and helped each other, especially through the winters. Didn't matter what color you were, where you came from, whether you worship Christ or whether you worship Buddha or were Jewish. You know, anyway, happy holidays to you. When are you going to have your Christmas show on, Steve?
Just the Tuesday before.
Okay, great. Well, Thank you for letting me share with that.
Always appreciate.
Labrador. Yeah, that's going to be really cool. I'm sure they need it now because since I've left Boise, the population has gone from 250,000 to over 615,000 in the greater Boise area. So, let's just say, well, thank you for letting me share.
All right. Yeah, Bob, and it goes into a whole list of people that have called up and told us of experiences of things that have happened to them and to family members. I don't think it's anything that either Elizabeth or our Chief Mew need to react to here, and I think it's probably a really good time to take our break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. You've heard of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Well, now you're hearing about Giving Tuesday, a day to kick off the season of giving back on Tuesday, December the 2nd. Celebrate the season of giving with Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Community Foundation on Tuesday, December the 2nd by giving a gift to the cause you care about most. When you live and give in Alaska, you make a real difference in your home community.
+1 800 478 8255. Our telephone number is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about police issues, profiling, deadly force, militarization, things like that. And we got a big stack of phone callers, and I think we'll just go right into some more of them here. Megan joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Megan.
Good morning.
Morning.
So my question was, obviously with the protests and the rest of the country, the big issue is race. And I think that one of the things that is so frustrating for the people there is they feel very outnumbered. What I'm trying to get at here is, like, you know, I think diversity in the police force is a huge issue. And so my question was for the police officer and how diverse is Anchorage's police department? Because it seems logical to me that if you have a police force that is mostly white, you're going to have a lot of pushback, whether or not it's deserved. If you're a black person that feels already that you have to come over a lot of adversity and feel persecuted against anyway, you're not going to trust a white police officer, and there's going to be some contention. So, do you think that if diversity could help, and how diverse is the police department there?
So I'll take it in two chunks. First of all, yes, I think a diverse police department is a very good thing. I think police departments ideally should reflect the makeup of their communities. I think everybody agrees with that. The next question is, how do we get there? The third question is, what is the breakdown within the department? And I can't quote all the figures off the top of my head, but I can provide those. If the caller wants to send me an email or something, I can sure send her those. But we are not nearly as diverse as we would like to be, and I'll tell you that right up front. It's not from lack of trying. We recently went through the numbers of all the various steps along the way of the recruiting and hiring process and broke them down by ethnicity and by race to see if any one group of people was being weeded out at a different rate than the others. And they all came in from the best to the worst performers by ethnicity within about a half a percent and a half, 1.5%. So we think the process, once you're in the process, is treating all the applicants reasonably along the way. Although I will say women were washing out. And that may cause us to take a look at the physical standards in a different way. So we're trying to make some adjustments there. But in terms of the ethnicities, I think everybody who's applying is they're all working through the process with the same success rate, essentially. So what that tells us is that we need more interest in applying on the front end. We need to be better at recruiting. We need to get the diverse populations in the hopper at the beginning of the process. I think once they're in, they're going to be hired at the same rate as Caucasians. And you may be interested to know that Caucasians don't pass our process at the highest rate. They're like the second highest or in the middle. Asian Pacific Islanders, we're getting through at a greater rate than the other. They're the most successful in the process. Whether that proves out over time, we'll see. You also have to have fairly large numbers at the front end of the process. You will have maybe 1,000 to 1,200 applicants on the front end. When you get to the end, you're down to 30 applicants, and so the numbers get so small there that there's a problem with statistical significance. But we do watch those things closely, and we are trying to improve the diversity of the Anchorage Police Department.
Megan?
Oh, thank you so much. I actually, if I can just ask one more question. I was wondering, does the Anchorage Police Department report how many, shooting incidents occur by race to anyone?
Yes, we do. We did our first report with the university about a year ago, and we'll be updating it when this year ends. We invited, actually it came from this station, a reporter at this station wanted to look at some of that data historically, and the size of the project was massive, much more massive than the reporter realized. And so what came out of that was we got the UAA Justice Center to agree to conduct a 20-year study of officer-involved shootings at the Anchorage Police Department. We gave them total and complete unfettered access to unredacted police files. We gave the KSKA reporter the ability to watch and observe that study as it was conducted. And a year ago, I want to say a year ago, January, February, I might be wrong about the date, but I'm sure the report's still online over at the university.
Yeah, it was about this time last year, actually.
Yeah, they published the breakdown, and it covers everything from the racial aspect to the time of day, day of week, what kind of behavior went into the shooting, how many officers, day of week, location of town, type of crime, and the demographic data is in there. And now that we have a baseline, we'll be publishing annual updates as we go forward.
Well, we had just before that report came out, we come out kind of scary years, but just as a person doing the news every day, this has not been as bad as the last 2 years before it.
Well, the study will tell you that the average is somewhere between one and two officer-involved shootings per year, and that's been historical for 20 years. There were a couple years that had three or four and some that had zero, but averaging one to two. In 2012, we had five. In 2013, we had five. That caught our attention. We started to ask why. What we found is in at least some of the cases, we were seeing a new end game, if you will, to vehicle pursuits. Suspects were doing something different, and our old tactics were not helping us resolve those situations peacefully. So we changed our policy, we changed our tactics, we retrained our troops on how we were going to react to that particular thing, and I think that helped quite a bit. It's been over a year since, well, we just had one, but we went over a year without an officer-involved shooting after that. We haven't made a calendar year yet. There is, so far, I'm knocking on this table. It's, unfortunately, it's for Micah, but...
I've done it. It appears to work just as well.
So that number seems to be down to one for 2014, if we make it through the rest of the year.
All right. Thank you. And thanks for that call from Homer. Martha joins the program from Anchorage. Martha, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Chief Mew.
Hi, good morning. I think the caveat there in the chief's comment would be about diversity would be when they get in the door, comma. So the part about getting in the door, I had a couple of comments that I wanted to make. In listening to so many things on the radio and television and reading in the newspapers or accounts about the incident in Ferguson and how it might apply to Alaska, I heard that I haven't heard one account from a citizen that there was a bad interaction or a racist interaction with the police officer in question. Not that there hadn't been, but I have yet to have heard of that. So that's not to be in defense of the police department, but that is a comment that I wanted to make an observation. And I have a couple of things that I wanted to talk about as far as local. We had an incident of deadly force used against a resident of Mountain View, which is a local community that's largely a minority. And he was armed with a non-lethal weapon, which was a broken broomstick, I believe. And the response involved an officer who did not at the time have a non-lethal weapon, which would have been a taser, for example. So there were protests, there were rallies within probably eyesight of the police department around the block at the park. So these drew hundreds of people. and there was a lot of scrutiny. I'm just wondering if the chief could briefly say what was the result of that, and even if there is a legal issue ongoing, if he could state that there he cannot comment. So,
just stay right on there, Martha. And Chief Mew, can you comment on the TASI?
I can comment on some of it, and certainly I made comments at the time, and those are in the public record and so forth. We did have a lot of discussion about tasers, and there's more ongoing discussion on that. We are, frankly, preparing for trial in the TASI matter right now, so it probably is not a good time for me to go into some of the stuff now. Our attorneys would not find that beneficial. And but the historical record is sure there. And we did have a demonstration outside the police department that occurred during that period of time. And the police did not even respond to that. So there wasn't an altercation there between the police department and the rally. The rally was peaceful, and it went on its own, and I think accomplished what it wanted to do.
So, Martha, it's under litigation yet, and so we're not going to get much in the way of comment.
Okay, and my final comment would be, going back to the public comments that were made at the time, I'm one of the ones who spoke up, having been born and raised here in Anchorage and followed public safety both personally and professionally as a now retired journalist. And I brought up the issue that's been used in other cities, which is an independent civilian or citizen review panel with subpoena power. This has been coming up in Ferguson as a possible solution, along with things like small cameras that officers would carry to document events. So I would just like the chief to comment on the pros and cons from his point of view as a top public safety official in Anchorage. His comments about what he sees as the pros and cons of independent review panels with subpoena power in some of the cases here in town.
So I guess how I'd respond to that is by saying that certainly there are jurisdictions that have independent review panels. Some of those work very, very well. Some of them don't work very well at all. And that often has to do with who's on the panel and whether they come with predetermined objectives. And so I think it's fair to say that most chiefs would prefer to handle these things in another matter if the public trusts them to do so. And so our hope is to manage our affairs correctly and openly and trust that the public has confidence in us and that we still maintain control of our own destiny. If we lose that public trust, then we may be in a situation where a citizen review panel becomes a popular idea, and we have one in this town. So I'm not trying to dodge a Shane Tosse issue. A lot came out of that. We met with, for instance, this I can talk about, we met with the members of the Minority Task Force, the ACLU, the university, members of the Polynesian community who were on the task force, were on the subcommittee, and we had them go through all of our policies and make recommendations, all of our use of force policies, and make recommendations on how they felt those policies should change. That was one way that we were trying to demystify ourselves to our public. We will have, I'm rambling now. There was some other point that Martha made that I'm trying to address, and now it's slipping my mind. Martha, what else did you say besides citizens review?
Well, the one with subpoena power, but also
the cameras.
I thought that I had heard that there was some talk about a federal grant to arm our local officers. Each local officer would have the ability to have a non-lethal weapon at their disposal as a basic tool for the job.
Yeah, so are you talking a taser or something like that?
Yes, a taser
okay.
Or a non-lethal weapon, which...
Okay, I'll go ahead and skip to that with Chief Mew. Is there any possibility of getting funds for that?
Well, there is. I'll start by saying that every officer carries pepper spray, so they do have that less lethal option on their belts. We were getting into the taser issue slowly and carefully. during this time period, and still to some extent are. I am. I don't want to use the term amused because that is not. This is not an amusing topic. But up until Shane Tosse happened, we felt that the community. It was amazing to us that after Shane Tosse, that people were saying, "How dare the police department not have a taser with every cop?" Because if you look around and look at what's happening in other jurisdictions, the courts were skeptical of tasers. The minority community hated tasers. The media hated tasers. And taser program was new at the Anchorage Police Department, and we did not want to overplay our hand. We did not want to just throw 350 tasers on the table and say, okay, guys, go to it, and lose the program. We wanted to see, we wanted to gauge community community acceptance. We wanted to watch where the case law was going, what were the courts going to be comfortable with. We wanted to watch the developing medical technology come through, you know. And so we weren't ready to jump in to 100% taser use. Now, I think we've noticed that the public's acceptance, at least in Anchorage, of tasers is quite high. And we have expanded the taser fleet since then. We're still not at 100%. We may get there someday. There is some cost involved, but I will not tell you that cost is the major problem. It is a problem, but we can deal with that.
I want to go to Elizabeth in listening in Washington, D.C. Nationwide, what's the climate on tasers?
Yeah, you know, we've been focusing on. I want to comment on a couple of things that I've heard so far, if you don't mind. I'm really appreciative of the perspective of Chief Mew, and a lot of things he said is directly in line with some of the things we're arguing, and particularly just about how local of a decision these things appear to be that the Anchorage Department is working with. That's something that we've been really concerned about, is that some of these federal programs, he mentioned that a lot of what they've acquired is not necessarily through 1033, but maybe was purchased on their own. And I do want to point out there is grant money that's available through the Department of Homeland Security and through Department of Justice to help purchase some of these things, and that does include less lethal items such as tasers. You know, I think that there are divided responses on these things. It's one of those things that require a lot of local scrutiny and a lot of local decision-making about the appropriate level of use within their own community, and that's something that making these things so available on a federal level, both through funding and directly transferring them, does sort of prevent this conversation from happening that we're having right now. And you know, the focus of what we've been working on is just to return it to that local level and to hope that law enforcement can be as deliberative as Chief Mew is being, and there are many other law enforcement officials that have expressed his same concerns and have gone through that same sort of deliberative process and just been so transparent with everything. That's something that I was really impressed by, as he discussed putting what they have on display, making sure the community knows what they have. That's something that's not necessarily required everywhere, and that's not necessarily done everywhere, and some of these federal programs do allow law enforcement to kind of run around the local approval or local consulting or even local transparency. And that's another thing the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act would do, would be to require that transparency. So a lot of good deliberation there, and that's something that I hope we can encourage by reining in some of these federal programs.
You know, I am wondering, I would probably really enjoy going to a hearing if you can get a hearing on that bill.
Yeah, you know, so they actually, there's been two hearings that are pertinent so far, and I would definitely encourage you to look them up on, like, C-SPAN or something and check them out online, because there were some fascinating questions and some things that were thrown around. The first was on the Senate side. The Senate Homeland Security Committee did a full hearing on just the issue of police militarization more generally immediately after Ferguson. And then here recently, the House Armed Services subcommittee did a hearing on specifically on the 1033 program, and there were some really good questions that were asked. And at both hearings, a gentleman from the National Tactical Officers Association was there, and he brought up a lot of the same points that Chief Mew brings up. And his organization is really concerned about sort of an over-SWATification that's happening in a lot of different areas as a result of some of these programs. And so there was some really interesting discussion that happened in those.
Over-SWATification, man. I learn something every show as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Over SWATification, Chief Mew assures me we do have a SWAT team in our town, but we still have community policing too, yes?
Well, yes, and, you know, I, notwithstanding all the things we said earlier about the, you know, I don't want to underplay the SWAT thing. We do have a SWAT team, a very capable SWAT team. They have the best in training. They got the best in equipment. And if you see those guys, you know, they're going to look military, and I don't deny that, so I don't want you to think I'm soft-pedaling that. But how we use them, when we use them, you know, we don't use them often. We only use them, we think, when it's appropriate and when it's necessary for that. And we do most of our work in, you know, traditional blue uniforms. We are police officers. We're city police officers. We try not to make our day-to-day presentation, our day-to-day philosophy, our day-to-day work look like something else. Unfortunately, the day and age we live in, sometimes that becomes necessary. But hopefully we have the wisdom to know which is which and do it appropriately.
Mark Mew is Chief of Anchorage Police. We're also joined by Elizabeth Beavers of the Friends Committee on National Legislation in Washington, D.C., with a D.C. angle on all of this. It's a fascinating show. Again, Dennis joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dennis.
Good morning, Steve. Your show, and you have not lost your luster. Over-swalification has a shiny chapter in Kodiak. However, the good news is that's in the past. Three things I want to touch real quick on. It's a documentarian's dream to come and show the three different law enforcement agencies in Kodiak. We've got the Coasties, the Wannabes, you know, some are soft, some should have never been given authority. With the exception of our local police department, who is obviously enforces verbal judo, kudos. I can't say enough about our today's police force of Kodiak. However, the troopers, for years I've heard these rumors of the misfits of troopers that end up in Kodiak. Well, I'm here to tell you it's not a rumor. I won't get into detail about officers like Mitchell, who made YouTube. However, the media has definitely has a negative connotation today. You turn on the radio, and here's this whole country's media trying to push the negativity of law enforcement. There's a huge responsibility that's biblical that comes with law enforcement, and in Alaska, law enforcement is not who you have to fear. It's the people who not the ding-dongs or the mentally insane, but the people who protect their own families with the legal right of packing their gun. And anyway, great show. Glad to be part of it. It was worth the wait.
Dennis, I might have known somebody from Kodiak would not pull his punches. Thank you so much, Dennis, for joining the program. And let's go to very patient Renee, who's listening from outside of Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Renee.
Good morning.
Glad to have you back on. Glad to have you back on.
Thank you. And many years ago, I was a board member for the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. Nothing I say here represents them, but that is a small piece of my history. I have been present in a vehicle in Alaska when it was illegally searched. I was the driver in a traffic stop. No ticket was issued. I was illegally searched and had commentary made about a shoulder holster on the dash that was nothing shy of baffling. My daughter recently, a couple of months ago in North Pole, was a passenger in a vehicle that was illegally searched. I have personally been aware of cases where microcassette recorders, and this is something to keep in mind with body cameras, where when the recorder would have shown that the officer stepped over the line, it was an illegal domicile search lacking a warrant involving shoving a 60-something-year-old man backward in his own door with no warrant present based on the smell of cannabis. Amazingly, with the Haines PD, that microcassette recording was quote-unquote misplaced. Okay. I know of cases in this state recently where attorneys have exposed officers on the stand for perjury under oath, a B felony. If you look at testimony by Alan Dershowitz, who some people dismiss as a defense attorney, you can also look at Norm Stamper's writing, Breaking Ranks. He was former Seattle police chief. And I can't recall the name of the former Philadelphia police chief who also did some writing about inside department corruption. See Gary Wainwright, a former friend of mine and an attorney in New Orleans, put away 26 officers for crimes ranging from racketeering to murder for hire. He has some interesting commentary on that. He still talks about it. He doesn't yell it. It's a dangerous thing to yell. I'm more than aware of the practice of rewriting arrest reports to match what should have happened rather than what did happen. I'm aware of taking information and embellishing in the writing of an affidavit for a search warrant. All of these are B felonies, and yet none of them are prosecuted that I'm aware of. I have yet to see a B felony of this nature prosecuted. Here's a person that, because of social conditioning, a law enforcement officer, we're trained to respect, believe, etc. Juries tend to believe officers more than they do the average person testifying, and yet there is some research out there that says perjury amongst law enforcement, in that they are far more often exposed to testimony in court, they're much more calm with it. I mentioned the last program on the East Coast, it's referred to as testifying. Here's a person who can change your life forever, either through the court or all that's necessary in a use of lethal force is a statement to the effect of, the subject made a furtive motion I feared for my life. That guy's on 3 days paid vacation and home eating dinner in most cases and usually reinstated. He may or may not have some internal friction go on that causes him to leave. And I hear, well, these are bad apples. These are the limited bunch. Most of them are good guys. Tell me, when's the last time you saw one of the good guys file or arrest, because these are crimes, arrest a co-worker for the felonies at hand. And these cases exist, and if I were off the air, I would give you specific cases involving B perjury. And the judges, the most I've ever heard from a judge, is a tongue-lashing about the unbelievability of the officer. Where is the B felony for a person who can change your life forever, sitting on a stand, getting caught lying red-handed? And I don't mean gray area lying. I mean flat, bold, in-your-face lying.
All right, Renee, I don't really, thank you. I don't have a panelist to comment on that, and we're out of time. Thank you very much, Chief Mew, for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Elizabeth Beavers, thank you so much for joining us from Friends.
Of course. Thanks for covering this.
And thanks for listening. Next week, Talk of Alaska, can invasive species help us out? Thank you very much to our crew. We've got Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, and Ashley Snyder. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.